direct from the web, it's Billy Masters Live. And now, please welcome your host, Billy Masters.
Oh my God. Hey, everybody. Hold on a second. We're live. We're live. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Billy Masters Live. I am joined, oh, I should tell you, for those of you who don't know, today is Thursday, December 16th, and we're skipping all the introductions. For those of you who are watching live, I'm saving you a little bit of banter by our man on the street in Montclair, New Jersey, the author of this fabulous book, All in the Family, the show that changed television, Jim Colucci. Hey, Jim.
Hey, how are you? I'm sorry about being here out on the street. I thought I'd add some local color.
Thank you. What am I looking at? What is that, an apartment building behind you?
It's a random apartment building where I found a stoop that seems high enough to get a signal.
And there's a nice little wreath, so there's a little holiday motif going
right
on.
In other words, I planned it. I planned my, this is my holiday background. That's what I meant.
I love it. I love everything about it. Jim, for those of you who don't know, Jim is a writer. He's written for numerous websites. He's a contributor on numerous television shows. He wrote a book about the Golden Girls, which, of course, is fantastic. We've had him many times on this show as a guest, as a panelist. Jim, I think you broke the news of this All in the Family book on this show.
I probably did, yes, because that was around the time we were talking, I wasn't sure whether I was supposed to break the news, because this book, like the show, is Norman Lear's baby, and I was brought in to help work with him, and didn't know whether I was supposed to talk about it, but believe me, I wanted to shout it from the rooftops. When you get asked to work with a then 98, now 99-year-old legend who's still at the top of his game, the answer is always yes. And you want to tell everybody about it.
And how were you asked?
I was asked, I knew an editor who was working with the publisher I had worked with before, and my husband Frank DeCaro had worked with before, and they knew my Golden Girls book, and so they knew what I liked to do, and it was a good match.
And did you have to, like, jump through hoops? Did you have to get Norman's approval? What was the process like?
No, I was brought in once Norman already was all set to talk All in the Family. This year is the 50th anniversary year. The anniversary was actually this past January, the 50th anniversary of the debut of the show. And so Norman wanted to talk about it in book form. And so I got to work with him and get the stories out of him and out of his other directors and producers and actors and crew. And never mind, go through all of the treasures that he had in his files that no one had even had opened for 50 years. All these file boxes that had 50 years worth of dust on them, but had treasures within that no one has looked at since then. And I was like a kid in a candy store. I got to dig through it all.
I want to show people. So there are things like original scripts that have crossouts. There's memos. There's telegrams. There's fan letters. You can't really see, but there's fan letters. I mean, there's so much stuff. And you had told me a story off camera at one point about you and your husband, Frank DeCaro, going through the boxes. Was it on Norman's tennis court?
Yes, it was that after we had really worked out a lot of what the words were going to be in the book, we were concentrating on the visuals. And so people who worked with Norman said, you know, we have all of our storage from the show off site. If we had them deliver all the file boxes from All in the Family, we can put them out on like Norman's tennis court or something. And the reason they said that is because it was in the height of a COVID scare right before the vaccine. And of course, I didn't want to go near Norman. He's a 99-year-old national treasure. Went during COVID. So they said, we'll put them on our tennis court and you can just dig through them. Well, it was like 105 degree day, the day that they got these 30 boxes out of storage. And so they didn't put them in the tennis court. They put them in Norman's very nice air conditioned guest house. And Frank and I had a lovely day digging through 30 boxes that had never been opened in 50 years. And it was a kid in a candy store thing. Yeah, I had to pinch myself. I'm going through Norman Lear's files. Even he doesn't know what's in here. And I'm in his house. You know, that was great.
You know, last week we had Bob Mackie on talking about his book, which ironically enough, your husband wrote the first book about Bob Mackie.
Correct.
And that book is also set up very similarly, where it's not just a photo book. There is a narrative. There are scraps of papers, the sketches of Bob Mackie. In this one, what I love is you get a real feeling of the creative process that went into specific episodes. Obviously, you can't do every episode, but certainly many of the watershed moments in television are gone into, where you have weren't there telegrams and FBI files? I mean, there was so much stuff that I don't think people realized.
Yes, well, the government did, the FBI did keep a tab, and Nixon kept a file on Norman, and he was on Norman was on Nixon's enemies list, which Norman is very proud of. it's all of that hand annotated script pages where you see what characters originally were named and what lines that are now famous, what they were originally intended to be, and you see places where there are moments that we love now that weren't in the script, like Sammy Davis Jr. kissing Archie. That was not in that script, and you won't find it in that script. That was something improvised by the actors during rehearsals and shown to Norman. So it's an amazing way to dig in. This book is an amazing way to dig into a show that ended up influencing every TV show that came afterward. And you see the kind of seminal moments now. Sometimes they happened almost by accident.
I always try to talk to people about things, because this show has such a gay audience and we have so many gay guests, that things that you wouldn't talk about necessarily with everyone else. I want to talk about the Beverly LaSalle episodes, which is so interesting, A, for the time, and B, because it was an arc that spanned, there would be like months, and then all of a sudden something would come up in this case, in a tragic kind of way. But Beverly LaSalle was it the first time on television, or certainly the first time on primetime, that kind of a character?
Beverly LaSalle wasn't the first gay character in primetime, although she was very early. Well, they called her a transvestite. Those were the words they had back then. There was no transgender identity that people knew of very well. But they called her a transvestite, and she performed in a drag act in a local club. That's why she was in town. So, but she was given such dignity. What's really important about her, not only was she early for any kind of LGBT character, because there hadn't been many before her, but she was a character who shows up in Archie's cab. And yes, the storyline is that Archie gives her mouth to mouth when she faints in the cab, and Archie is mortified that he gave mouth to mouth to a man, as he says it. But the joke is never on Beverly. It's not about what a ridiculous creature she is for being a man dressing up. Those are not the jokes. Beverly is beloved by Edith right away, and the family takes her in and really loves her. And the jokes are about how Archie is narrow-minded and how Archie is embarrassed. It's not at Beverly's expense, which is so groundbreaking.
Not only that, but there is a huge shift in Edith's character when Beverly is killed, and it she goes twofold. It is because she's dead and lost a friend, but how she is killed and why she is killed. And Edith, it's so funny, because Edith is always seen as the simpleton character, but as in Shakespeare, the simpleton character asks the most profound questions and has the wisest answers.
Right, exactly. And Edith is, you could say simple, but another way to say that is pure. She's a pure, right, loving person. When Norman would often get accolades for creating such a good Christian character. And I tease Norman saying, you're a Jewish boy from Connecticut and you created this ultimate Christian. And there's a Protestant clergyman who wrote a book called Edith the Good back in the day in the 70s about how she is a model Christian. So, yes, she may not be educated and erudite and well-read, but she has a basic, simple, pure goodness to her. And that's what made her love Beverly from the beginning. She loved Beverly without judgment. She saw Beverly as a wonderful person. And when Beverly debuted, that character was so popular that they brought her back twice more. And you would think that that character could have been controversial, and then they could have, could have gotten raked over the coals for bringing her on television. But it was quite the opposite. America fell in love with her, to America's credit. That's pretty progressive. And Beverly came back twice more. And in that third appearance that you're talking about, she was killed in a hate crime. And that was kind of, they worked backwards. They wanted to do an episode where Edith, who is so faithful in God, loses her faith, and they worked backward. What horrible thing would it take to get Edith to lose her faith? And they came up with the senseless killing of a beautiful friend whom she loved, like Beverly, would be the only thing they would think that would shake Edith, because there could be no making sense of it. And it was such a, that episode is such a tour de force for Jean Stapleton, showing how much she loved Beverly, and through her, the audience loved Beverly. She gave us the permission to see the good in Beverly, no matter what she was wearing. It didn't matter that she was in a dress. We saw what a fun, wonderful, loving person Beverly was through Edith's eyes.
And also, the end of that episode, you see a little crack, as you often do, in Archie's bigotry, showing his humanity, A, for Beverly, and B, helping his wife regain her faith in something, whatever we want to call it.
Yes, that's part of the brilliant writing and acting of All in the Family, because when you think about it, Archie could have just been a hateful character, but you add Carol O'Connor and his charisma, and that face and those, the twinkle in those eyes. And then you give him some lines where he does show humanity, where he does, you know, try to make his wife feel better, even if he doesn't understand what she's feeling. And he does, you know, by the end of the series, he softens and he's raising a Jewish stepdaughter in Stephanie. So he does, Archie does grow and change over the course of the show in subtle ways. And that's to the show's credit. And I think that's one of the reasons why it was beloved by both left and right, which is something it would be hard to do today. Because if you're a liberal, you could watch the show knowing that Archie's intended to be, for the most part, the fool of the piece. If you were a conservative, you could watch it thinking, oh, see, he says
he's
all
the
things
voice
we're
of
not
reason.
To say. He's the voice of reason. But you also, as a conservative viewer, I think, would watch it and realize he's not a pure monster. You know that liberals are making this show, but at least they're not making your conservative hero a pure monster, because he's got a heart in there somewhere. And so I think that also appealed to the conservative viewer.
Well, I think that Norman Lear has done that throughout his career, that he has had multifaceted people, that liberals aren't all on the left, that, you know, the in All in the Family in particular, you find moments where Rob Reiner's character finds that, oh, I've got some of this. I have things in common with Archie that I'm not so proud of, but I have to acknowledge them. And one of the things I love about this book, again, reminding people, there's the book. Are you being noticed that you're talking on a television show, Jim?
Every once in a while, somebody jogs or walks by and they're looking at me like I'm a crazy person hanging out like a, you know, a street urchin here in Montclair, but that's okay.
Rex Smith is backstage. And he's wondering what's happening. So people who don't know, Jim Colucci was delayed at the doctor. He didn't want to miss the show. He stopped on the stoop of an apartment building in Montclair, New Jersey, and is doing this show from there to the amazement of passerbys. Jim, what I love about this book also, All in the Family, the show that changed television, is that you do a lot about both the successful and unsuccessful spinoffs of All in the Family, and also what came before it, and Norman's career, and really the landscape of television at that time. And I really didn't know a lot of the stuff after All in the Family. I knew, kind of a little bit about the proposed black version, that a black family ends up buying Archie's house much later, and how the various spinoffs fit into it. Was there anything surprising in that you found that was news to you?
Well, not surprising, because I was around and following television during this time. But when you look at the number of shows that All in the Family begat, some of them successful, some of them not, but then they even had spinoffs. It's seven shows. For one show to have, you know, spinoffs into seven is, and it shows the power and the brilliance and the bandwidth of All in the Family, that there was so much depth there to mine and then create another show out of. So All in the Family created, from All in the Family came Maude, the Jeffersons. Good Times came from Maude. There was a spinoff with Flo from the Jeffersons. We had, as you mentioned, 704 Houser, which was the attempt in the 90s to move a black family into Archie's former house. Gloria. I mean, it's just some of those succeeded and some of them didn't, but they all had interesting points of view. And they all came from that original bedrock of All in the Family, which had so much to offer.
And how hands-on in all of these shows was Norman?
Norman was very hands-on, especially with All in the Family, and especially when it was the only show. As his empire with Bud Yorkin grew, and they had Sanford and Son and other shows that weren't even related to All in the Family, but they had this big empire of shows, Mary Hartman, One Day at a Time. Obviously, you can't be everywhere at one time, and you can't be in every writer's room all the time. But Norman had an interesting setup where he would have groups of writers come into his office one by one each week and pitch the show that they wanted to write. And he would give them notes or approvals or yes or no. And he would tape record all this stuff. So
really,
he had to really multitask. When you think of how hard that is to set your mind deeply into the world of Archie Bunker for an hour, and then those people leave and somebody else comes in, and all of a sudden you got to switch your brain over. And now you're worrying about Ann Romano. And now you're worrying about Maude Finley. And those shows are different. And they have different points of view. And you have to really just track from one to the next in such a deep way that you can get to the marrow of what each episode should be trying to say.
And you have to really think of those characters that are so different. And the characters, again, some occasionally crossed over. And that's sort of like a big jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, when you draw the world that they all live in, and there are inconsistencies when you realize that Florida Evans lived in the area of Tuckahoe, New York, when she worked for Maude, and all of a sudden when she went home, it was to Chicago, to the
right,
project.
Exactly. Chicago.
That really makes sense, but okay, you know, it worked for the show. Most shows of an earlier era did not anticipate that we would have any way of checking up on their fact checking them, other than syndication once a day for, you know, Monday to Friday. In our local stations, they didn't realize we'd have streaming, we'd have DVDs, we'd have the internet, so that we could all compare notes and say that doesn't make sense. So they would do what worked best for the show that week.
Yeah, I've been watching, as a matter of fact, I've been watching Maude on, I think it's Antenna TV, and I realize how many of the shows I never saw. And the other thing is sometimes when they'll have two or four in a row, you kind of wonder, you know, they're giving me information again, because they were expecting a week later you might need to be reminded, versus I just saw this a minute ago.
Right.
And even within the series, it's like, oh, that doesn't really make sense. But if I saw it 2 years later, maybe I wouldn't notice that. So right. It's all been very interesting. What do you think Norman, if he were starting today, what would he be able to do? Because I watching All in the Family and Archie Bunker's Place is on right before Maude on Antenna TV. So I've been watching those as well. And Maude, those ones that really tackled social issues seem to be as relevant today as they were then. Except I don't think that they could get on the air today. Which is fascinating to me.
They couldn't get on the air in the same way. And certainly a lot of the epithets that Archie uses could not be said on the air today, even by a character who we were supposed to know is wrong for saying them. So, you know, that's, you can argue the pros and cons of that. I think you can make an argument in either direction for that.
Which argument would you make?
You know, I don't need to hear the N-word on TV. I realize that there are people who really, that is painful for them. And yet right. I do want us to have the conversation about why that word is wrong and be able to get at least near it to have the conversation. So I don't know which side I fall on. I really see both points of view. And it's not just the N-word, but other things that Archie said.
I do
think it would be really hard to get a show like any of Norman's groundbreaking shows on the air today, because not only the issues that it brings up, but because we have such niche media now that you only have to appeal to one side of any audience. You can do a show just for liberals. You can do a show just for conservatives. And so to get All in the Family on, which was intended to show both, and appeal to both, that's really hard to do. Norman thinks it can be done. So with the, every time I've interviewed him, including the one that's streaming now through Live Talks LA that debuted last night,
yes,
the last question I ask him is, yeah, it was really fun. The last question I ask him is always, you know, could you do this today? Would you do this today? His answer to would you do this today is simple. He says no, only because he's, and it's true, he's not the kind of person to look back. He wants to keep creating new and say what, and make more commentary about today rather than using an old vehicle to do it. Let's, you know, create something fresh. So that's an interesting answer for a 99-year-old man to say. But when he's
particularly when I say, since he just did a reboot of One Day at a Time.
Well, he did. Yes, that's true. But, you know, those things were brought to him, as was Live in front of a studio audience, brought by Jimmy Kimmel. Norman is not, you know, he's no Norma Desmond sitting around watching his old clips on the screen with the projector. He has moved on. He is always in the
now. You are setting up my next guest so perfectly.
Oh, good. Well, Norman is always in the now. He is so current. That's why he is so vital at 99, because he stays so current and vital. But I, when I ask him, could shows get on the air? His answer is, I don't see why not. And when I start to say why not, well, political correctness, well, he says, I understand why you're asking. But his point is, we still have those issues. They haven't been resolved. Why not? Why not discuss them? And so I see his point. I and maybe somebody with his 800-pound gorilla power in television could get a show on the air. But as I said, he's only looking forward.
You know, and the last thing before I let you go, before you are arrested for soliciting, there was you brought up a really good point in the book, which I think it cannot be minimized, is we look at something like All in the Family through today's eyes. And back then, there were three networks and, you know, a couple other independent channels in each market that had some reruns. But you had three choices, so the market was not fragmented. So you really did need to appeal to everybody. You couldn't have a show that is going to exclude half the audience. It wouldn't survive.
Right. Right. They were broadcasters in the literal sense of the word. They had a broadcast to a broad spectrum of people because there were only three choices. Nowadays, you can find, you know, the network for just people exactly like you because there are so many choices. And that's good and bad. Shows can be made that really have a specific voice that say something that's never been said before. But then again, you may be the only person watching. And if a tree falls in the forest, does it have any effect on anybody else? So it's like everything about technology, there's every step we take forward, there's a step backward as well.
I know what your next project is. Do you want to tell people what it is?
I do, because I need your help, Billy. Rex was on the Love Bug.
Okay, Rex is backstage. I would like to show a clip of Rex Smith, and I am going to give you the opportunity to ask Rex Smith a question. This is Rex Smith on The Love Boat. You gotta love those red pants. Down the street, I remember everything about you, oh, so sweet. So warm and tender. Ooh, I can't stop loving you. It's all I wanna do. Every time I see you. I had to leave that on so that you could prove it's the Love Boat. Ladies and gentlemen, the multi-talented Rex Smith. Hey, Rex.
Hi.
You know, so, Jim Colucci. Yes, go ahead.
I have something to contribute to what you're talking about on Archie Bunker, because that was the result. The Love Boat was a result of a movie I did for NBC called Sooner or Later. And it was a story of this guitarist and this love story with a girl who was underage. That would you make that today? But it was a coming of age thing that has that really set fire to my career. But Denise Miller was the star, the co-star in it, and she starred in Archie's Place.
Yeah, so she did.
That's right.
So it just keeps coming around and around and around. You know, and that you saw in that clip, the shot of in that thing, the captain's daughter had a crush on me. And I believe me, the Teen Idol had hit the fan at that point, and I just could not take my next album after that was called Forever. And I actually, the cover of it is, I autographed it because I did so many autographs, you know, on albums that I said, let's just pre-autograph it. But I remember I was doing the thing and I was autograph, kiss the cheek, autograph, kiss the cheek, autograph, kiss the cheek. And it was a guy going like, oh, yeah, well, no charge for that.
Jim Colucci is now writing a book about the Love Boat. So, Jim, do you have a question for Rex?
Yes. Oh, Rex, I hope we can talk off air and Billy will hook us up to talk about your appearance on the show. Because how could I distill even that clip we just saw into one question? All I can say to you is that when I have been mentioning to friends about who I'm looking to talk to for the Love Boat, and I mentioned to a couple of friends my age who are women that I wanted to talk to you about the Love Boat. And they may not remember that much about the Love Boat, but they remember everything you were wearing and what song you sang. It's like it's fresh in their minds. That is a very formative moment, that song you performed. Which, now tell me about the song. What was the song?
Yeah, what is the song, Rex?
I wrote that song. It was on an album it was on the Sooner or Later album. And it's a song I wrote with my brother, Michael Lee Smith, and my cousin, Emmett. And what's interesting about it, we wrote several songs, and Columbia was interested in us being the American Bee Gees because we have very similar
lives. Oh, sure.
And because of legal entanglements and this, that, and the other, did not come to fruition. But hey, you know, we were at the table with that kind of offer being proffered, which was interesting, a really interesting wrinkle, something that I was more than happy to try and include family in sort of the juggernaut that I was on at the time. Let me tell you about the Love Boat, though. The girl that I leave the ship with, I took her skiing. I took her to Vail. We went skiing. But before that, she had a little Porsche 914 with the top off, right? I had a driver taking me out of the Fox lot. We're just going, you know, in through the lot to go to the gate. She pulls up next to it, beep, beep. She goes, bye, Rex. And you know, she's in a little car. The driver's in a high car. He's looking down at her because she was pretty voluptuous. He's staring at her, and he ran into the fire hydrant in the lot. And 50 feet of water is geysering up. She's bye-bye. And we're like stuck in the car up on one wheel. And so that was my very first thing. I remember walking around the stage. It was the first like TV thing I had done. And mm-hmm. I was in on the on the controls of the ship. And I was looking at it was all wooden knobs and stuff. I was going, gee, this looks so fake, but the camera makes it look so real. So that was an education.
Wasn't it amazing how that whole set, that pool was on a set, and everything looks so good and so real and when we see it on screen. And then if you ever see behind the scenes photos and you see the tops of the scrims and you see where the lights are and you realize, boy, that is so fake. It's just this little kiddie pool on a stage, and they make it look so real.
Well, there was a lot of bathing suits in the foreground.
Yes, so, you know, that to distract you. That's right. There was a lot of eye candy to distract.
Jim, I want to thank you again for being on, and thanks for bearing with us. And you
I will connect you too.
Very interesting. What your arc is and what your aim is really. Just the subject matter is very important. Well, Love Boat is more. You know, I don't know if it outdistance Norman Lear, but
it's different.
It's a photo finish.
Yeah, it exercises a different part of the brain, definitely.
Yeah, I think you'll have a good audience for that.
Oh, I hope so. Jim, thank you, and happy holidays to you and Frank, and I'll talk to you soon.
Happy holidays to you guys. Thanks so much.
Cheers.
Bye, sweetie. Rex Smith, who I just spent last weekend with, we weren't able to hang out because of COVID, but Rex Smith is appearing in Love Actually Live. How many years have you done this, Rex?
This is the third iteration of it and the third cast, really. It's been not totally, pretty close to totally recast this year. It is, it's almost when you work with Shane Cheel and For the Record.
Shane is amazing. Yeah.
They hook you in with just such sterling work that it's hard to walk away from her or even contemplate it. You know, it is the talent that they put together. I tell you what, if we were a baseball team, I'd face the New York Yankees. We got the Dodgers of talent up there. Really. I mean, this is a unique show. It's never been done, a hybrid show. It's hard to describe. That
it is
a problem. It's a bit of a problem that you can't hang your hat on it, but we'll find a way. But it, I just look at it, I try to describe it, it's a movie and a Broadway show at the same time. And
and a concert.
Yeah. And but and Jesse Vargas, who is the master,
music director.
That has created all the music, all the has really put a selection of music and his depth of knowledge in music. I told him he was born in the wrong century. He should have been in Vienna with a powdered wig, you know,
with Mozart,
with a patron, you know, they have him. But I'll tell you, one, here's a great thing about the show that I'm really experiencing this time, because last year, Shane, who is the tireless producer, and I love his enthusiasm, and you know, you have to imagine this show's in its third year, but it's 6 or 7 years of work to get it to this point because of movie rights and everything with Universal. And it's a million strings that need to be constantly attended to that could come unravel. And he called me and he said, Rex, what do you think about doing the show at a drive-in? This is when we were in the middle of COVID lockdown.
Oh.
I said, I don't think I can stand in 50-degree winter in a pair of gold shorts, you know, and wearing only a Stratocaster and cowboy boots. I don't know how that would
work. There you are, by the way.
Yeah, my Liberace.
And, you know, just to give people a little better idea. And you look incredible. You know, Rex, I don't want you to walk away from this feeling like me too'd, but you are staggeringly beautiful. You still look incredible. What is your secret?
Clean liquor.
Oh. And we should tell people, it is playing in Beverly Hills at the Wallace. If you want to try and get tickets, it's almost sold out. It closes New Year's Eve, thewallace.org. I don't think that we can minimize the multimedia aspect, which is extraordinary, with moving parts and videos. I mean, it's incredible.
In the ever-shrinking attention span of the world, they have come up with almost a YouTube, a cell phone app environment of screens coming in, portraying a scene from the movie, and then out walks a character this way.
In the same outfit.
Embodying that and goes into song, you know, and I play Billy Mack. Now, two Billies here right now, two Billies.
Yeah, right.
Right. But I played also Billy Crocker and Anything Goes.
True.
Billy Bigelow.
Yeah.
So, and Billy Matt. So I'm pretty Billified myself.
And you, it's a perfect role for you. It really is because it plays to your strengths. The only thing that you don't really get to do, and a lot of the live performers don't, is they don't get to really act scenes. Because, again, we're seeing the scenes in most cases on the video screens. But as I said at the top of the show, you are really a multi-hyphenate singer, actor, Broadway, television, film. It's is there something that... Well, that's true. And the first superhero, was it Daredevil? Is there something that you have not done, not a role, but like a media type or something, like, you know, on
stand
your
up
bucket
comedian.
List? You kind of no, you kind
I'm
of do that
comedian.
In your one, yeah, in your one man show. You really do that.
That's true.
And you have great stories. People, if they get a chance to see you live, you have great stories. Speaking of which, so I'm going to ask you stories that I don't think you've talked about a lot. The first story, explain to people how this picture came about.
Well, that is...
I know how, so... Not a bad picture. It is.
Richard Avedon shot it, and with that wonderful turn of the century, the last century plate camera, right? White. I don't know. It was on Fifth Avenue or what. His studio was like a brownstone. It was white. And Columbia had sent a rack of designer clothes, you know, like, you know, from the it was a full rack, like from Nordstrom Rack, let's say, of
everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hugo Boss or whatever you name it. And I came from the gym, right? And, or I was going to the gym after. Anyway, I was just wearing
in those sweatpants. Yep.
And he said, he looked at me, he looked at the rack, he went, take the shirt off. And we went to work. And
ta-da.
That was the shot. That was the shot. I'm really incredible that I stood in front of Avedon's camera that shot Kennedy and everyone else, you know. Speaking of which, this is an interesting thing. Classic. I don't know. There's me and Jackie.
Rex.
Shirt,
I've got
no
it.
Shirt, once again. No,
okay,
sure.
And Rex, he has another version of it. So that was the next question. Rex, let's discuss this.
Mike Nichols, okay, that is opening night, the first night in the Delcourt Theater, Pirates of Penzance.
Mm-hmm.
And I had hidden a... Not hidden. It was very simple in the back, you know. It was trash cans with linings full of ice and wines and beers and things and such. And I had a bottle of champagne for Kevin and I. And I was in the dressing room, and I ran out. And I remember as I ran out, I ran smack into Meryl Streep, and she gave me a kiss. Just a hug and a kiss. And I ran. My jeans weren't even buttoned up. I was just fishing out the bottle of champagne. So you don't see that thing is I'm holding a bottle of champagne. And so I said, Rex, get a picture. And it's a delight because Jackie O, the fabulous, was the hardest woman to photograph or whatever, to get her smiling or anything.
And there you are in a series of photos. Go ahead.
No, she was just, Pirates was the holy grail of my theatrical career. I was very young, and I just thought, "Hey, it's gonna all the shows will be like this. Some events, not." But
you know, it's interesting because I have a friend that moved to New York right out of college to be an actor, and within a week was cast by Stephen Sondheim in a revival of A Little Night Music. And I said to him, because I have no filter, I said, wouldn't it be funny if your first Broadway show is the highlight of your career? And he's like, it's going to be awfully hard to top this.
Yeah. I think, really of all the, I've done six starring roles on Broadway and six national tours. One is a 6 to 2 year commitment, and that is a lot.
Absolutely.
Of standing delivering. That is one people go to me, they go, have you, do you have little touch-ups? And I'm like, no, I just have lived an 8 show a week life where you have a responsibility it bleeds into everything you do, how you raise your kids, how you do everything. You're just hands-on, and you just are tireless, and you're...
Well, it's also your whole life. Freddie in Pirates is no joke. Freddie has the biggest part in the show, and yet sort of is, kind of taken for granted.
Well, here, now, concerning that, this is, I was such a new guy and everything. Everyone got a Tony nod, except me, and Wilfred Leach. We were at the crossover backstage, and it was the day after I was a little knocked down. And he said, Rex, you have to remember this, that the show is called The Pirates of Penzance or The Slave of Duty. And
you
are the slave of duty, and you have to be the ground force for all these balloons that are floating in the air. And if you join them, the show will float away. And it is one of those things that it was just the balm I needed, and just the encouragement and recognition from him of the work that I was doing for the show. But I tell you, Kevin Kline's the godfather of my youngest daughter, Savannah.
Oh, wow.
And I've written a movie called The Pirates of New York that it's funny, in Montclair. I was just in Montclair last month, and I had breakfast with Kathleen Marshall, who choreographed
fabulous choreographer.
Kathleen is real interest. I just got today that the first week of January. We're continuing with, we have representation by a major entity, and Kathleen's looking to direct. And it's the story of Kevin and Linda and I and that magic summer. But also,
wow.
Here's the twist to it. It was almost to the day, 100 years, Gilbert and Sullivan only opened one show in New York in their whole career, and that was the Pirates of Penzance trying to combat piracy of their work to trademark.
Oh, right? Wow. Right, because so, people would put it up under different names and change the story. Yes.
Would come in and right. grab it and go. So they opened it in New York, and we took a show that was to the day when we opened on Broadway, within a day or two, 100 years old. It was the 100th birthday. And yet when we received that, call it the script for people, not the book or whatever, so people understand.
Right.
We regarded it that the ink wasn't even dry. And that was the marvelous yeah. thing. He was talking, casting. Wilford was magnificent in his casting prowess of pulling this mm-hmm. off. When Linda came, listen, my record company was ticked off. I mean, I was supposed to be on one of the biggest tours coming on. You know, I was on a roll.
Yeah.
And Linda, too, was playing stadiums, right? But
now you're going to be stuck in New York for a year or so.
Well, I walked away from that. I also had a movie, a big movie, but mm-hmm. I walked away from that to make $250 a week on the stage. And in your career and in life, you hit crossroads. You don't recognize what a crossroad it is till you have the aspect to look back on it. But that
Absolutely.
Was the smartest $250. I was walking away from $200,000 to work for $250. And it began a thing that I really have this movie, The Pirates of New York, with Leila Dam is my producing and writing partner. It really wrote mm-hmm. itself. But the thing shapeshifts or time shifts from Gilbert and Sullivan in 1880 to 1980 with Joe Papp. It shifts back and forth with the two casts and characters. So it has that, I think it's an element that is very attractive for audiences of time travel and such. And it's
and let's
true.
Look at, and let's look at, here's a photo, I think yeah. the first table read.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's
and so there's you, Linda, and Kevin, Kevin, Joe. I mean,
Tony
unbelievable.
Cito and George Rose.
And who do you look at? The hot guy in the tank top. I'm sorry to say.
Linda. When I met her, they had put up a life size poster of me, sort of as a. Not a slur, but you know, like, oh, who's this guy, right?
You were coming in, right, as a pop star.
To shame me kind of thing, right?
Right.
Everybody's yeah. in their grays and blacks with the thick socks and the dancers warming up and everything.
Theatrically, yeah.
I walked in a white LSA tennis outfit because I got Thank up
you.
Early and played tennis before I went to meet the cast first time. So they're all waiting for me to see that and be embarrassed. And I just went, that's nice, but the real thing's so much better. And Linda,
thank
you. People broke up and laughed. And I remember what really was a moment for Linda and I when we first were walking towards the piano and stuff. I took her hand and I said, it's like going into church, isn't it? And it was that was the first step of a wonderful thing. Now, Kevin, Juilliard, master of Shakespeare, Kevin Kline. Well, mm-hmm. I'm from the South. And so I'm reading the line, and the line goes, pray you get you hence, young ladies, right? And I went, pray you get you hence, young ladies, right? We went on break. Kevin grabbed me, dragged me in the stairwell, and slapped me. And he goes, get. This is Gilbert and Sullivan, not hee-haw. It's get. And I went, I'm going, I get it.
Once you have get, you have everything else.
Kevin, and he says, and it's duty, not duty. Duty is something babies do in their diapers. Because okay? Okay? I have the line, I am the slave of duty. So when Kevin comes to see me in a show, eventually he's going to go, I heard you say get. And, you know, he's always, that ear is always watching. And I, you know, do you know what an explosive lesson that was in enunciation, which I had to really you know, the mid-Atlantic, oh, pity me, beloved friends, such is my sense of duty that once out of my indentures, I shall find myself bound to devote myself heart and soul to your extermination. What a beautiful poetry.
Which leads to my question, did you have acting training? Because that is a heavy thing for somebody who's a pop star to jump into.
Here's what had happened. When I did the movie Sooner or Later, mm-hmm. My first two albums are just called Rex. That was what I signed a 6-album deal when I was 20 years old, Columbia Records, managed by Aerosmith's managers. When he made the deal, he said, you have 5 weeks to put a band together, write and record your first album. You're going on a 6-month tour opening for Ted Nugent, Cat Scratch Fever, the biggest tour of the year. So I did 2 6-month tours touring with Ted. AC/DC was my opening act. Okay. I was rock and roll.
Oh, jeez.
Was good time rock and roll. And that's where I come full circle with Billy Mack. At the end of the show, I'm back in Madison Square Garden going, you know, the show's gone over to the rock star scenes, right?
But what did you want to do? Did you want to be the pop star? Did you want to be the theatrical actor? What did you want? Okay.
Rock and roll. That I'm just born to do that.
But everything else you just fell into?
Yeah, and I tell you, in a good way, but I've never called myself an actor, right? Mm-hmm. I'm more of a mercenary in a good way. I'm a delightful mercenary. I am... if you have a problem and you need it solved on stage, give me a call and I will go to work for you. So I really am a soldier of adventure. And here's another thing about, especially many people, okay, you know, they work, they live to work, right? But I, mm-hmm. in my career, I work to live because my life is the adventure that I want to live. But imagine this. The adventure of my work to parlay my adventure of my life has been an incredible doubleheader that is just, I am,
indeed.
You know, when I turned 60, gratitude came into my life and it informed me and it becomes more and more rich of everything I look at every day, something to be grateful for, many things, right? And it is, you know, now looking back, yeah, it would be impossible to have worn as many hats as I was able to do in a career to just follow curiosity around so many corners, you know, and not be known for just one thing.
But do you think that diversity has sort of stopped you from excelling in one or the other things? Because there's always been that idea, even today, that, oh, Rex Smith in, I saw you in Grand Hotel, you're stupendous, but it's like, oh, it's that pop star in Grand Hotel. Right. There will always be that perception for some people. Is that bad? Right. It sells tickets,
it,
I guess.
It is what it is, you know. When the movie Sooner or Later, when it came out, it was NBC Movie of the Week. And the next day, I went on my motorcycle. I rode down to Bloomingdale's when there was only one Bloomingdale's in the world. Right? That's when New York was New York.
And yeah, I know.
I'll buy a sweater, buy a thing, something. I was at loose ends, you know. And I hear these people screaming. And I look, and Bill Cosby is being interviewed, much like you and I are doing right now, in some setting. They had some light set up with camera crew. It was for the news or whatever. And I remember thinking, God, that guy can't go anywhere. And then, you know, 20 minutes later, I was locked in a dressing room.
You were that person.
300 girls trying to break it down. And the New York, you know, NYPD is going, who the hell are you? And I go, I don't know. I was in a movie last night.
So, I read a quote. You said that when you recorded the song, the Take Your Breath Away, you said, the minute you started singing it, you could tell that your rock career was disintegrating.
Well, here's the thing. That was my first day of filming in a movie I'd never filmed before. I did my first day of filming. Then at 7:00, I went to Record Plant, recording studio in New York, and Charlie Colello, who was the fifth season. He arranged and produced.
The architect. Yeah.
So, yes. And wonderful, because I did the album Sooner or Later and Forever with him. And I loved working with Charlie. And we got along like just as fine as two, you know, as a producer and artist could. So this is my first song. I've just met him. Hi, how you doing? He goes, I got the track ready. Why don't you go in there? So I put the headphones on and I'm going, give me a little more treble. Can I get some, hey, give me some more, a little reverb. That sounds perfect. Doing a headphone mix. And I said, let me just run it. I wasn't even expecting them to run tape, right? I just wanted to
rehearse it once.
One time, right? Yeah. So all I'm doing, I mean, luckily I didn't like spit or anything. I did it in one take and he goes, come on in, we got it. And I was like, because I've done two albums before that and I double track vocals and all that stuff. I said, no, that's impossible. He goes, come on in. So I go in there and he goes, I want to show you something. He goes, roll the tape. And there was like the faders, the little slides for volume. There was four faders of four voices going, whoa, take my breath away.
Oh, to be background.
He goes, I didn't know how good you were. I don't guess we need that. And so he started playing it. I said, okay, let's hear it. And I'm listening. About halfway through, I said, I got to go to the bathroom. I went and locked myself in the bathroom. I looked in the mirror and I started really to cry in terms of, there was also the moment that I went, I just recorded a hit.
Right.
I just recorded a hit record. That's what it looks, tastes, feels, and sounds like.
And you can see where that's going to lead.
I'm waiting 6 months for the movie to come out, right? My band has been disbanded. I can't really work. And I was complaining to a friend going, I don't know. I'm just going nuts, riding my motorcycle around New York. He goes, why don't you go audition for Danny Zuko? I go, what are you talking about? I said, well, there's an open call in New York tomorrow. Anybody in the city can go. There's Zuko right there. That's me. That's the 39-year-old Zuko. That's second.
Yeah, this is the second Zuko, right. Zuko.
Okay.
And you were the last Zuko of the original cast.
Correct.
Of the original production. Excuse me.
Yeah. So that was, and then the Tommy Tune, that was two different worlds, right?
Right.
The original one. So I go, there's 1,000 guys in line. I go, and the guy before me was like Mel Brooks. He's like, thank you. And I sang, and the girl was obviously a secretary. I mean, an assistant or whatever. She goes, we're going to want to see you again. And I'm walking to Beatlemania that my producers created, I mean, my managers, and my buddy was the stage manager. I'm walking to go tell him about the day, and two guys in business suits come up. They go, hey, are you an actor? And I'm like, you're in the middle of New York going, maybe. And they said, we're the casting directors for Grease. We've been following you for five blocks, and you are Danny Zuko. I went, guys, you're a little late. I just came from the audition. And they looked at each other, and they went, don't take a job. And they ran around the corner. I felt like Marlo Thomas. That
guy, right.
It was a New York minute, And so I'm doing the show on Broadway. And
how long were you in it?
Sorry?
How long were you in it before when you got cast till it closed?
Well, I was the last one, right? So I did it for several months on Broadway. The show was closing, but they said, Rex, we want to do one more national tour, of course, with you to get this thing on the road. So I went out on the road and did it. The great thing about Zuko is, what a perfect training thing for a guy from rock and roll to stage of right, stage course. Left, upstage, downstage. This
it's and the boot other. Camp, theatrical boot camp.
My first dictatorial suggestion comment was on the very last audition. There was four other guys for the Zuko. We're down playing gin rummy down in the green room, and it's at the Royal Theater, and it's almost a thin little staircase, dark. It was built in the 20s, in like a submarine movie. They go, Rex to the stage. I'm going like, that's me. And I'm running up the stairs, and I can see the lights of the stage on the last flight of stairs. As I'm running, my head hits a low overhang, and I look up, and
it says,
watch your head. I'm seeing stars. I walked out going, oh, man, I just banged the dude out of my head. And my first direction on Broadway from Tom Moore, who was in the house.
I know Tom, of course.
Yeah, I go,
original director.
Boop out of my head, and he goes, use it. And while they were all laughing, I took a standing eight count and shook it off, and I got the part. So
You're so smart and so lucky. I mean, and whatever they do, don't damage that face. God, it would have been tragic. You know, your pop life and your theater life kind of intersected with this next clip, which kind of led to a job for you. Let's just play it, and then we'll discuss what we just saw. Okay.
My eyes fully open to my office situation. I should go over to Maybelline or make a reservation. I would tell her I am bound by duty and my moral senses, and I don't know what to do about the pending consequences. Now I do not want to perish by the sword or by the dagger, but a pirate must indulge a little pardonable swagger and a word or two of compliment my vanity with flatter. But I've got to go tonight, so it really doesn't matter.
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 So it really doesn't matter. This particularly rapid, unintelligible patter isn't generally heard, and if it is, it doesn't matter. This particularly rapid, unintelligible patter isn't generally heard, and if it is, it doesn't matter. Matter, 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 matter.
That is East versus West, the Frederick from Broadway and the Frederick and the LA tour, Andy Gibb, on Solid Gold when you were a guest.
And I ended up taking over the show.
Replacing him and then taking over the show. What was that like?
Andy is a dear, dear young man, and he really should have just stayed in Australia. You know, this is a treacherous business, and it is the fact that I navigated these rocky shoals and everything. You know, I'm a grandfather. I've got five kids and two grandkids, right? And a very grateful life. And
it could have all gone the way Andy Gibb did. It could have very easily.
Yeah. But here's the thing. I always went to bed before the sun came up. Okay?
Well, there you go.
I told people, I don't see the need or desire to be up for 3 days with cold pizza and a hooker and a test pattern on the TV while you're like this. That doesn't interest me. And also, I got shows to do and everything else. So my drug of choice has been that adrenal rush of the downbeat of an orchestra before a show. I mean, that fills my cup. Now, Andy was terrifically, you know, crippled by drinking drugs. Mm. And what's funny is, here's the story, a Solid Gold story. I'm guest hosting. They've got me in Bungalow 7, Marilyn Monroe's bungalow, Howard Hughes.
Oh, wow.
And I have the cabana in the deep end of the Beverly Hills pool. And this is when the Beverly Hills pool was the Beverly. People were getting a call on the phone going, telephone for Rex, you know, so they could screen and walk down the thing. Well, the producer and I are having the McCarthy salad, which I don't know who chopped it, but they were perfect squares of celery, you know, cheese, egg. I mean, just somebody had to do it like sushi. It was, you know, it's Beverly Hills Hotel. I'm in my red Speedo. He goes, Rex, we're prepared to offer you $500,000 to host Solid Gold next year. And I went, yeah, I have my fork. And I said, you know, when you go to the fair and you hit that thing and try to boom, ring that bell.
Mm-hmm. Said, yep.
I'm not hearing the bell. I got up and I walked two steps, jumped in the deep end, like in The Graduate. I was my breath. I could see him looking down at me through the wavy water, and I pushed off the bottom and I came up and his hand was out and he took my hand. He goes, how's $1 million to host Solid Gold? You just don't know what they're thinking, right? He had $1 million in the trunk. Yeah.
And you grab it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so anyway, here's the deal. I bought a open cockpit biplane, a Great Lakes, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a pilot. So I was, and I took lessons and everything. I was flying aerobatics. So while Andy was locked in a bathroom in Malibu, I was flying inverted, waggling the wings while Linda Ronstadt and Jerry Brown were waving towels at me. I'd go, listen, I'm going to buzz the house at 11 o'clock, you know.
And living your life, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, parachute, goggles, open cockpit, stick and rudder. And I even had my dog, Palomine, at the time, a wonderful dog, who can be seen. I should show it.
I don't have that. See, you would think I have every photo. I don't have that.
Oh, well, here. This is a classic. This is a classic. Hang on.
Okay.
This is, let's see. This is, that's Bianca Jagger.
Yep.
Having her ear licked by Palomine. And look, it's Rex with no shirt again.
Well, that's a look, you know.
She guest starred on Street Hawk. So that was on the lot. But anyway, Pal was a classic. But I had Pal's face like nose art, like a World War II plane. I had a pal of mine painted on the cowling of my engine, you know.
We had, for our 100th show, we had Marilyn McCoo and Billy were here. And right, so, and that, which is one of the things that made me think of you. And I just want to show a clip of you and Marilyn singing together. And then I want to talk about the fact you sang an off. It was really hard, but I picked a medley of two of my favorites. So here we go. And check out the pants. Aside from being a great singer, was there anybody more beautiful than Rex Smith ever? Ever?
I'm taking the fifth on that. I refuse to comment.
I mean, what is it like walking around looking like that?
It was pretty damn good. I can't deny it.
Can I tell you, so many people I will ask that to, oh, it was no big deal, I was just like you. You were not just like me. And Marilyn McCoo, also stunningly beautiful. Oh. Were you? Did you sing live on that show?
Yeah.
Or were they, everything?
Yeah, and I
because you sang everything, every week.
If they can't play that show on TV, I imagine because of performance
rights. Right. Yeah. Right.
If it played, people would be watching that. I'd be doing a show in Vegas. You know what I mean? I mean, like, I look at Ryan Seacrest. I go, what exactly does he do? And it's like, hey,
right.
How you doing? I had to go, hey, Tom Jones, how are you? Or, you know, and then work with the puppet. And then sing the puppets, you know, so. But you know, there's no complaints to the thing. But I always assumed, like, by the time I was doing Solid Gold, it was a mixed bag because Joe Papp
from the Public Theater in New York.
Joe was towards the end of his career, and he said, mm-hmm. "Rex, I'm going to do this as my gift to you." What is it? He goes, "I'm going to put you through the canon of Shakespeare. You are going to perform all of his work as much as I can put you through. It's going to change your life." And here's, you know, Meryl Streep, Christopher Walken, Kevin Kline. I mean, this is a pantheon of greatness. I'm sitting with him. This is incredible. And he's got me to do Midsummer Night's Dream. He's already told the director I'm in. The director was like, "I don't believe this. You don't have to audition for me." I said, "I think maybe, you know, Pirates was my audition. I mean, I'm not trying to give you a hard time."
Sure.
Which Joe says goes. But I said, "Joe, they've already structured it. I'm starting work on what was my last album in California, mm-hmm. and I can't push stop on it. It's already in motion." And he said, "Go make your effing money." And I said, "Joe, it's not about that. I signed this deal when I was 20 years old. That was a heart wrenching thing for a long time. Solid Gold was like, so I went from, you know, showbiz is stud poker. You get five cards. You got Joe Papp. You've got Shakespeare. You've got this. You've got everything. Four
and
cards.
What do you play?
Always going for a straight. And then Solid Gold comes in really kind of to save the day because the album, I did that. But what was I going to do after that? I went from absolute the opportunity of the purest art form to the purest pop art form.
Commercial. Right.
They were both equals in terms of weight, in terms of responsibility, what I had to do. One was on the pop side and one would be on the dramatic. But
But as I said, you know, it does sort of pigeonhole you that then to go back, some people might not consider you, even though you have the chops to do anything. I'm trying to think of something you couldn't do. It's really difficult.
You know, what's funny, when Solid Gold, I did a year on it. And then after that, I signed up and I become my first, you know, superhero Street Hawk series, you know, which ultimately George Clooney got his first part. On, he got a SAG card because he played my best.
There you are, Rex.
He died in my arms. And
Rex, there he is, George Clooney. You say a name and it appears.
Oh, yeah.
You're both babies.
You're Dr. Evil. You're Dr. Good, you know?
Oh, no, because I want my get. Look, I don't have people on the show I don't love. People think that, like, because, you know, you've done a lot of shows where this person, you've got to have them on. If I'm not interested, I'm not interested in talking to you. There's also, this is a pretty good picture. No, and I don't even get to see your face. I know. Okay. So we have to go because we got so much to cover and I can't. Oh, and, you know, Rex. Oh, Rex, did we lose you? Look at that. Are you there, Rex?
Are you there?
I'm there. Yep. Rex, look at you again, naked, practically.
You're in the show.
Yep.
Can you hear
you're
me?
You're in. I hear you.
Why do I have no
Can
sound?
You hear me? Oh, I don't know. It's
Why
okay.
Do I have no sound?
I'll put, come back in. Come back my. In. No, audio. Do you have me? Do you have
my
me?
Phone audio. Hello? Hello?
Okay. Oh, hold on. Oh, this happened once before. That's okay. One second. Hold on.
Can't hear. What the heck?
Rex.
Dang, Mike.
Come back in.
That's mute.
Okay, hold on.
I am.
Okay, Rex, come back in. I will. Come hold on one in. Second. Right.
I'm trying.
Okay. Rex will be right back. I know he will. We know how to do this. We've done this before. Oh my God, Rex Smith. We're not going to show this clip to him, so I can show it now. Here is a clip of him in, oh no, I don't have it. Look at that. I got so many clips of Rex Smith singing, but I want to show them to him. Can I just show you before Rex Smith comes back? Just look. Was there ever anyone more beautiful than that? Oh, my God. Wait, you got to see this. Look at that. That's Rex Smith in his young days and then Rex Smith today. Rex, hopefully you can hear me. I'm bringing you back
I'm
in.
Here.
Okay, Rex, I knew when I kick you out of the studio, that resets it. Okay, Rex, we got the most important part of this interview. I don't think you've ever talked about this. Rex, who was the first Norma Desmond that came into your life?
It was Faye Dunaway.
Okay. Rex, and, go. Tell me.
Okay.
Because I know some of this story, and I have my own issues. I've had interactions with Faye.
Let me go ahead.
Right
off the top. From
Please.
This is the an absolute. If any actress was portraying Norma Desmond, it was Faye Dunaway was born to be that character.
Absolutely.
She was the last of the, just look at her in the Thomas Crown Affair in the airport with the hat. And she was the last, you know, almost contract movie star. She was of the ilk. She was
golden age. Yep.
She was the last Norma Desmond.
We're Absolutely.
Both from Jacksonville, Florida. I didn't know that, but we worked 5 weeks together. On
How did you get cast? How did you get
here's
cast?
Here's the thing. Here's the thing. I flew to New York. They flew me to New York, and I didn't make it past the musical director in the cut. And was
the one that Kevin Anderson got to go to London? I think it was Kevin.
Yeah. So,
okay.
But here's the thing. No, this was...
Why would you not make the cut from the music director?
That's what Andrew Lloyd Webber wanted to know.
All right. Thank you. Okay.
But you know, Glenn was doing the show...
In Los Angeles.
This was for the bridge. It was going to be Glenn for the New York thing. And
right.
I was Glenn's date to the Golden Globes when she was up for a Golden Globe.
How does that happen, Rex?
I had 104... I had the flu. I was just sick.
Did you sleep with Glenn Close?
I'm not good.
All right, I'm just asking. Okay.
Okay.
All right, go ahead.
So I'm sitting with Elizabeth Taylor by this table, and I go, I go, Glenn, I got to go home. She's going, what? And I go, I can't make it. I'm going to pass out. I told you I had the flu. And she's gripping me going, you're not leaving me the Golden Globes.
Yeah, thank you.
And I said.
On a live telecast.
They had one of those, probably one of those people that just fill seats when people get up. You know,
the seat fill. I have been a seat filler.
Waiting in the wings for the big bonus.
Yes.
I didn't know if that was it, to tell you the truth. But Glenn came to my opening later on in Toronto when I led the Canadian company. I flew in, I met on that thing, didn't hear from anything again. And then I had gotten up and gone surfing, and I went and got some takeout Chinese. I was on my bike, and I came, and this was when it was playing at the Schubert with Glenn.
Yes, I remember, with Glenn.
With the script and everything, and the music, and libretto. And I went and I met with Andrew and, you know, various people. I sang for him, and then, see, they offered me the original Rum Tum Tugger, right? I flew to
London. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
And I went to see the original in New York, and I went to see the production with Andrew and with Trevor Nunn, right? Then after mm-hmm. Trevor Grant.
So they knew you.
We're back at Andrew's palatial estate kind of thing, and I'm going, well, let me understand this. I'm wearing cat makeup, yeah. And I don't get any billing, that's right. And you want 52 weeks with no outs, yeah. And the money is, and I said, okay.
Not good.
Thanks, but.
Theater money.
Right? Yeah.
Right.
And so anyway, I sing for Andrew, and then he goes like, suddenly he goes, you're the young man, Rum Tum Tugger. I go, yeah, that's me. And so I get to the car, and they go, you got the deal. I said, great. And he goes, it's even better. They doubled the offer. So I was remodeling my beach house, right? And I always wanted a Wolf stove because I went to culinary school, and I'm pretty deep in my culinary talents. And I never had a Wolf stove, but I had a Wolf stove being brought in to this remodeled kitchen and everything.
Well, anyway, and now you can afford it.
I'm in rehearsal for 5 weeks. Now, that show, Joe Gillis, is like the Manchurian Candidate. I mean, that is...
He is the show.
You're all alone. You have that one scene where, you know, $500,000 worth of costuming passes by at the Paramount.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just you alone.
When you first meet Faye, how does the first meeting go?
Wonderful. I think Faye was a bit like Linda Ronstadt in terms of, she knew from the get-go that she was in good hands with me, that I was going to look
okay, so
her.
She was confident about you. Good.
Yeah.
And, not confident about her voice.
Well, it got so strained of what they were doing to her about her voice that at one point, and I got in some hot water about doing this, the director heard me talking to her. I said, listen, Richard Harris, Richard Burton, you know, Camelot. I go, the audience will forgive Norma Desmond everything. Believe me, when you come down those stairs and you go, great day, you are Norma Desmond. But the
absolutely.
Minute you try to flatten their tongue, they were centered to like three different voice coaches, flatten your right. tongue, stick your chin out. I go, you try to compete with Barbara Streisand, and the minute you try to sing,
yeah, right.
then they're going to put you in that canon of these singers, and it'll be horrific. And Trevor, Rex, I don't think you're... you know, capable of direction. I go, oh, look, I'm trying to save the show, okay? I mean, I knew I could see what was coming. So they flew her to London and back to discuss taking it down a half step. I went, I could send right. one of my kids to college on what you just said. And anyway, so here we are. We're doing, this is lightning striking. The only me kind of thing. Here I am mm-hmm. 5.5 weeks into the thing. We're doing the dress rehearsal, which what's going to be the New York company is moving on with plugging Faye and I
right.
in. So it's the most expensive day. There's no audience, full orchestra, sets, makeup, thing, boom, lights. And every day the girl would bring me in my little lunch of like a tuna fish sandwich, ruffled potato chips, and a peach iced tea. Well, this day she came in and I went, oh, thanks. She goes, that's $7.35. I went, oh
no.
I guess, well, the show's opening, so I guess the free lunch is over. Oh, it was over all right. So we do the first act. I'm now coming back, and I'm digging into my...
And how does the first act go?
It's pretty splendidly. It's not...
Okay.
It's okay?
Because there's a tape circulating that I've never heard, but there is a tape out there.
I'm eating a sandwich, and the assistant goes, Trevor would like to speak to you. I go, okay. I stump my cheeks like a squirrel, you know? I'm still chewing on it as I go down the hall to go think.
You know? Because you open the second act with your biggest number. This is right before that.
Yeah, and I didn't... It's a dim, you know, the dimmers are down in the office or whatever, and Trevor's sitting there. It looked like a scene from Network or whatever when Ned Beatty's So I go and I'm still chewing the thing, and he goes, Rex, sit down. Hmm? He goes, you know, Faye's never going to do this show. And I'm waiting for him to say, so we're bringing in Betty Buckley or something like that, right? He goes, so, and it goes into slow motion. So we're closing on Sunday. And I was like, what? He goes, do you need to call somebody? I said, I need to bring my mother back to life. So I go staggering out the door. And now it was telephones then. Some people had cell phones, but people are running to the payphone down in the dressing room area. I heard a guy going, honey, it's not going to happen this thing, but don't worry, we're going to New York. I was like the kid in the Pied Piper, you know, that can't.
Because you're not.
Everybody's going to New York except me or whatever. Now I'm
because it's going to be Alan Campbell and Glenn Close.
Yeah. I'm sitting there going, I go upstairs and there's a girl singing on stage. And I'm going, what are they doing? She was auditioning. And she's out there going, singing her heart out. And then she came. I'm standing in the wings. She passed me by with like that actor to actor, 1,000-yard stare look of like, what do you think? And I walked out and they were almost like, oh, here comes the next guy to audition. And I went, I don't know if anybody's got anything to say to me, but is anybody going to effing say goodbye? And Trevor comes up and goes, Rex, you're going to leave wherever in the world. You're going to lead the next company. I go, I can do it with the monkey. I don't even need her. I go, you know, now here's about Faye. Here's another thing.
Okay,
Faye
please.
To answer the phone, Faye took a good hour. Should it be like this? Should my
favorite? Everything's a little slow. Yeah.
Al Pacino can do it. And they go, wow, a master at work. A woman does it. She gets the rep of going, oh, look at this bitch. She doesn't, you know, she's taking forever, right? So I sat there just doing the, taking it. And then we finally got the phone answered. And then she goes, how should I pick up the monkey? I went, just pick the monkey up. But here's the beautiful thing that made a really lasting thing with us. She had to practice slapping me, right? And Trevor's out in the house and she has to slap me. She's going, darling, try your fingers together. She's going, whack. And he's going, no. Why don't you splay your fingers like this? Like that. And he goes, Rex, you're starting to flinch. I go, you want to come up here and like practice? So she slaps him. I went, she's my mother. And she goes, she's my sister. She's my sister. She died laughing. And then when I was kissing her, I kissed her and I went, now kiss me like you kissed Steve McQueen. And she you know.
So you were able to have fun with her. I think we missed an amazing opportunity, regardless of how she sang it. And I agree with you. Had they adjusted the keys, had they let her Richard Harris sit, it would have been amazing. Although she does have to speed up a little bit. Well, but you did. So you left the, I mean, that ends and you get to eventually do the show When I Saw You. And let's just show a clip of this. And you did it with a divine woman, one of my dear friends. I know somebody you were close to. Let's just show a clip.
Sunset Boulevard, Frenzy Boulevard, swamped with every kind of false emotion. Sunset Boulevard, brutal boulevard, just like you will wind up in the ocean.
Aren't you Norma Desmond? Hey, you used to be in pictures. You used to be big.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
I love Diane, but she took about 20 minutes to get that line out.
Well, I tell you, one thing that's just amusing. The longer we did the show, the higher she got on, it's the pictures. That's not a slur. She was like a brand new, top of the line Jaguar car. She was plush and smelled the leather and everything. The carpet was was that wool, thick wool carpeting, you know.
Luxurious.
We did 650 shows together. That's a
unbelievable.
Lot of
and recorded a highlights disc.
Yeah. And just marvelous, marvelous experience with her. And, you know, like, just example, her dressing room, she'd have caviar and a split of champagne in her fridge. Mine was like Canadian
the
beer.
The tuna sandwich and the peach.
Some cheddar cheese that was turning green. But at least once a week, we would go to dinner together and just marvel at what we were doing, you know. And Toronto was a fabulous city. It was and made even more fabulous. It was before dumb phones, you know, where society and fashion and theater and things, and not diluted by it. But I remember there are instances where doing a show, Sunset Boulevard, was getting my ticket punched for this experience with her. There was a place called Top of the Senator that was in its day and up until whenever it closed, a premier place in Canada for the best jazz musicians in the world to perform. It was a small strip, like a small rectangle, not very wide, stage, big, huge picture window behind the stage, and giant velvet curtains that must have weighed half a ton, you know, parted over the stage. We're eating steak palm frites, right? We're having a drink. The bass player, a storm, New York was swamped, but the snowflakes were like that big behind, a kaleidoscope, like a snow globe behind him. The bass player is playing so hard he's having to tune the bass while it's boom, 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 just plucking the bass. And she leans over, she goes, "You know, my first husband," I'm going, "Hmm?" She goes, "He was the owner of Birdland." I go, "What?" She goes, "Yes." And she goes, "I was 18. And, oh, come on, the trumpet player, hey, baby."
Louis Armstrong?
Miles Davis was across the hall.
Miles Davis,
He was in love with her. So as soon as the husband was like, "Hey, baby, can I have a cup of sugar? Come on, sugar," whatever. And she was like, "Oh, I'm not," she wasn't doing anything with Miles Davis, but she was, that was a unique thing. And as I was sitting there having my drink, you know, my martini and my pommes frites, and going, this is the entree of what 650 shows gives me, this moment with this divine woman that I alone, which I'm sharing now with the world, but you would never get that in that kind of candid conversation, that friendship that is melded on a stage that you share together. It opens up. I don't care. I mean, for me, there's no TV set and stuff that builds the relationships that the stage does.
It's such an intimate and intense hothouse that people don't realize on the outside. I saw you in the show. I was friends with Diane, and she introduced us. And I said to her, "He's so beautiful." And she said to me, "You have no idea." And that stuck with me, because she would not say that about everyone, as you know.
Well, we were the best of friends and supportive of each other, which is, you know, she needed bucking up for, she had personal things, her marriage and stuff like that, because, you know, her Vic Damone came one time to see her. I mean, you know, it was a lonely existence for her, and she was, even when we went to Vancouver, she was contemplating to just leave the show, and I had to really, you know, the producer said, talk to her, bring, you know, and I convinced her to carry on, and she was glad she did. I mean, you know, you have to face a lot of fears, potentially, on every time you go out on stage. Me, I don't read music. Okay. I can't read music. So I sang for Leonard Bernstein. Okay. He wanted me to do his mass. Okay. I will amend this story because I don't want to embarrass anything, but this is true. I did Good Morning America, and then I walked from Good Morning America to the Dakota. So I did that at 7:30. I go 11 o'clock to Leonard Bernstein, and he's got the, you know, in his place, the pianist is there and all of his gang. And so I've got the big sheet music, and I've been studying the music to sing the celebrant or the rock star in his
right, acts. Which was Simple Song. Is that what you auditioned with?
Sing God a simple song, laude, yeah. Laude. So I'm turning the pages, and he goes, he's listening to stuff, and he goes, holy, how can he sing like this? He's a musical illiterate. I'm going like, and then he's drinking four fingers of scotch, right?
It's a oh, yes.
Of, he's doing that. He's got the long hair. And this is true, so it's not, listen, and this is then, and there's a good ending to it all. He's going, sing it again. Sing it again. And then at one point he comes and he goes, he reaches upon his ear and he's got a joint as thick as my finger. He goes, you want to smoke a joint, baby? I went, later, maybe later. That'd be good. He goes, yeah, later, later. And he goes, I have an announcement to make. And they're going, what? He goes, he's going to sing the celebrant and the rock star. It's going to be a tour de force, right? And I didn't end up doing it, but I was so jazzed by the day that I went to my apartment and I was going, I'm a nut. He's a nut. He's a genius. That doesn't mean I'm a genius, but at least I'm a nut. And I was so, I didn't know what to do with myself. I went to the airport and bought a ticket and flew to my place in California, my house in Beverly Hills, and went and said, I got to get out of New York. It was one of the most exciting things to meet somebody that big. And as yeah. I listened to his music, because I listen to KUSC all the time, that's my station, classical. When mm-hmm. I hear Bernstein's versions of anything, you can feel his involvement. And it was just, listen, he probably thought I was a beautiful young man too, or whatever.
Yes, yes. And you did end up eventually doing West Side Story.
Yeah, yeah.
Where was that?
That was approved by him, directed.
Oh, he would have loved that. Yeah.
And it was the original costuming from the original costume house. The entire set as it was, 27-piece orchestra. They hadn't done that mm-hmm. since 1959 or whatever when it was the original. So it was even the conductor was the original conductor. So it was magnificent. We did that at the Kennedy Center prior to going on 52-week tour, but there was two producers and they sued each other because one wanted to get rid of the other. And federal marshals came and closed the show. I'm in my dressing room. They go, is that dance belt yours? I go, you're not taking the dance belt. And we had to get paid by Equity, who took the money from the box office because everything was frozen. We had to do a secret knock at a motel door, and we got paid.
Oh, my God.
So the adventures and misadventures, but it's all part of a great adventure.
Can I just ask you, you talk about food a lot. How do you eat and look like this? How is that even possible?
Well, that you got to take 40 something years off.
All right. How do you look like either of these guys?
Well,
look at you then and now.
When I do this show, I call it my house chop chop. I do celery, bell peppers, like colored bell peppers, kale, Spanish onion, and small potatoes. And then I do, I make like taco turkey, ground turkey, and I do mm-hmm. my own house dressing. And I take that to the theater and that, you know, I kind of live on that. I start out the day with 3 fried eggs over medium, and then I put mm-hmm. flip them back over, break the yolk, put a little grated cheese, coffee. I start out with blueberries, strawberries, and banana, and then I go into that, have my one coffee of the day, and that's kind of the day. And when I get home at night, I just made beautiful salmon yesterday, but I made a sort of salmon pate out of the leftovers. And when I get home at night, I'll have bruschetta and a little salmon and a glass of Chardonnay. And
Do you have a strenuous workout routine, or are you just naturally athletic and that does it?
Once they opened up the gym again, I was able to do that. For during COVID, all I could do was, you know, they had police tape on the outdoor gym at the park, and it was tragic, you know. But there was the basketball court, they'd taken the nets off, and there was a wall next to it. So I put tape up the height of a tennis net. And I would ride my bike there and play. I would just play tennis against the wall for like 3 hours, you know, and I'd do my jump rope and this, that, and the other. But it was a tough time for everybody, you know. But, you know, this show, it's a good thing to put in front of you because you start thinking about it, you know, a month or so out going, okay, let's cut back on this and let's cut back.
Get into shape. Well, and Neil, let's remind people, Love Actually Live at the Wallace. Get tickets at thewallace.org. I have one more clip I want to show you. This is it, Rex. We got to wind up because we went so long. But I could talk to you forever because I know you've got great stories. And you, what I love is there are people I say, was this interesting? And they'll go, yeah. And I'm like, that's it. Yeah, I ask you and I get a 10-minute answer. I love that.
It's an adventure. There's an adventure to every avenue.
All right. Well, I bet there's a story behind this clip. You know, you go down the rabbit hole of Rex Smith clips, you'll be there all night. Take a look at this and tell me what this is. What is that?
That's me and Captain Kangaroo.
You say it like it makes sense. What is it, Rex?
It's almost Stanley Kubrick, isn't it?
It's bizarre. It's almost like theater of the absurd. It's what it is.
It is a bit gay, you know.
It's pretty gay.
You got me humping a telephone pole. I mean,
I enjoyed that, Rex. Did you ever play a gay role?
You know,
because you should. In case anyone's interested.
The second one to falsettos, Dance of the Falsettos. The second.
Yeah, March of the Falsettos.
March of the Falsettos with Mandy Patinkin, right? So only that they flew me in for Sunset Boulevard. They the Weislers said, "Hey, we want him to audition for this with Mandy." So I told my agent, I said, well, tell them to upgrade me to first. You know, they can pay a little bit of thing.
Thank you.
And they said, this was such a Weisler answer.
Fran Weisler's not upgrading
we'll
you.
We'll do it, but if he doesn't take it, we get our money back, okay? So
thank you.
So I go and I work with Mandy on the thing, and I'm packing my bag back at the hotel, and Fran Weisler comes to my room. Ding dong, you know, knock, knock. I go, hey, Fran, I'm packing my bag. She goes, okay, we want you to do the show. I said, good. She goes, but the money, you know, the money's got to be what it is because, you know, favorite nation. But I said, well, whatever. You can talk to my agent. She goes, well, here's what I want to offer you. I go, well, what's that? She goes, we'll buy your groceries and stuff like that. And I go, how's that going to work? I'm going to meet with you every week. And I go, here's my graffiti.
And give you a list.
But so and also, wait a minute. The Normal Heart.
Yeah.
I read with the director and everything with Brad, it was before, you know, this was a reading.
Before Brad Davis,
It was a staged reading, but I was playing the lover. Mm-hmm. And
Joe, you would have been great in that role.
The director and Joe, we sat and he said, Rex, you're just so alive. It's just hard to imagine even making you, like, tamping you down as dying or anything. It's just, you're just exuberant. And so there was two. That's
has being as beautiful as you are been a down? Is there a downside to it in terms of how you've been cast? Are you too pretty to play certain roles?
You know what?
That's one, I guess.
Honest about it. This is third person. Speaking third person.
Yeah,
it
please.
Was all through high school and stuff like that, too, that it was. You know, people just looked and made an assumption that I had to break down those assumptions, you know, that just going, even, you know, people going, oh, life has been so easy for you. You never had to do that. Nobody knows the work behind the work, you know, the clubs that I played. And I mean, you know, I, in the South, I played 101 nights straight one time, you know, humping equipment, doing, playing, paying the dues. And you get through playing a club for a week, and maybe the owner, I'd go, there's only half the money. He'd pull out his gun and start cleaning it and go,
that's that, right?
That's all the money we got. So, you know, the trick is to make it look easy. That's the trick, is to make it look easy. And that is a skill set. So nothing is easy. I I've outlived my fame, and I'm the guy at Home Depot now getting paint chips to redo my bathroom or something. You know,
With that?
I'm so good with that, because it's not fame, it's infamy. You're just a moving target. You know,
well, I know people who have been so hot or have had the career. And I always think of somebody like Henry Winkler, who is grateful, but isn't living in that character. He's happy where he is. He's embraced it.
Exactly. Yeah. That is the greatest statement of a performer is how they treat their life off the stage or in the in-between.
Absolutely.
As I call it.
If they have a life off stage, a lot of them don't.
Yeah. Well, then you get the treachery of living to work, because then you're
right.
You know, like for me, the bowels and everything is just a perfunctory thing for me that's done. As soon as I've sung the last note of a show and it's done, I'm finished. I'm happy to do the bowels as part of the thing, but I've never been the adoration, because all fame is fleeting. All famous, please.
But hasn't the admiration also been good? Hasn't it been fun? Did you enjoy it?
The loneliest night of my life was at the very most successful moment. You know, when it was a Saturday night. I was in my penthouse in New York and just crying at the dining room table because I had lost every friend, saying, "You're not the same." I'd go, no, you're not the same. It's me. You know, you've changed. I go, no, you changed. And even if I met somebody that I was interested in, by the third day or something, go like, oh, I can't believe that I'm sitting here with Rex Smith.
And you see it in their eyes that it changes.
Yeah. And so.
But did you at least enjoy it yourself? Did you have a lot of sex, Rex?
You know, all we had was sex back then.
All right. Exactly.
And a nod was as good as a wink. And I can't.
That's okay.
There's decades and such of human experience, but to be part of that liberation, sexual liberation, and everything like that. I mean, you know, they're doing it still. Like I'm sure. I mean, I hear. I mean, they do.
Yeah, but you were part of that time.
Not TikTok, but it's removed the human element, because you had to have the skill set to be charming, to keep the ball in the air, to, you know, to parlez-vous. Right now, it's like Okay, yes, I agree to these following terms and accept the thing. Dude, I'll meet you at the bar, you know?
Well, aside from your looks, what impresses me most is your voice. And we have a very quick, like, 40-second clip that is so simple. And it's just you and your voice, but it's at an extraordinary event. So let's just show this, and this will be it.
Okay. I met a girl, a wonderful girl. I met a girl. You're my girl. The boys all know. You're my girl. I've told them so. You should have seen how their faces fell when they were wishing me well. They called me a lucky guy, and I couldn't hide my feeling of pride. You're my girl, I've chosen you to be mine my whole life through. And if this heart...
Ooh!
Billy Schrich, the Carlisle. I mean,
but again, what people should know is that simple, direct type of singing is the hardest singing to do. The showy stuff is easy.
Yeah, that's true. It is. That was I believe, the Tony Awards. And
yep. No, it was the salute to Julie Stein. So but right, Broadway salutes Julie Stein.
God. And three coins in the fountain with I can't remember the performer. And we had to share a mic, right? So it was
yep.
Like three coins in the fountain. He grabs it and goes, how right. much can it? And I've got to sing. I'm having to wrestle the thing like, one game for the thing. But I was doing the Tonys one time, and I was on a plane once flying from New York to L.A., and Bob Fosse was sitting like two rows in first class in front of me, right? And they had like snacks and stuff at the front. At one point, I got and made some snacks, and I'm kind of looking at the corner of my eye because I'm going, that's Bob Fosse. And so anyway, I'm listening with my Walkman, and we're like getting ready to land. They're announcing, you know, whatever. And there's a tap on my shoulder. I look up and it's him. And he goes, hi, I'm Bob Fosse. I go, I know. I've been here to make it. Came on. He said, I want to tell you something. I came and saw Pirates about 2 months, 3 months into the run, and your performance was like an opening night performance. He goes, I could tell. You give it all when you do it. And I said, thank you very much. And this is incredible to meet you. And then I was doing the Tony Awards once, and he had gotten the Tony. And I was getting ready just to go, and I did like four songs or whatever on it. Mm-hmm. And just before, I'm waiting to go out to sing, I think, Who Am I Anyway? My resume. And there's a tap on the shoulder, and I turn, and it's him holding the Tony. He goes, remember me? I went, get out of here. those are the best moments that you capture with your heart. You didn't have your phone to go, hey, get over here, take a selfie. You carry it forward in your spirit and your heart, and that's what you're.
And you connect with the person. Yeah. Where are you going to be doing your one man show again?
I don't know. The last time I did it, I was at Red Rock in Vegas. I did it on mm-hmm. Valentine's Day, and then the curtain came down, the COVID curtain, and it's been, you know, we're just kind of crawling.
2 years.
Out of the box, you know, I was just breaking sort of the casino thing with this thing because it's you know a self-contained show. All I need is video and a microphone
and a mic,
and I take you on a journey that is pretty incredible. And the stories, like we've been talking, we're just going, this is too good.
And this could go, you know, we could be talking another 5 hours. You are an extra. Again, I tell people, go to YouTube, look at the clips, go to your official Facebook page, because you're posting clips. I do love that one of those, I think it was the naked guitar picture, and you wrote, and I had to print it out, you said, if you had photos like this, wouldn't you post them? Because, you know, yes, I would.
You can't, if you have photos like that, you can't run for president, you know?
You know, but who would want to be president?
No, I know that.
Rex, you are a delight. I just want to tell people again, if they can get a ticket, because it's practically sold out, Love Actually Live at thewallace.org. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
The theater. It is like a Bentley. It is like a brand new Bentley. It is.
Oh, can I also tell people, it is so safe. So you go to the Wallace. They tell you while you're outside, have your COVID ID, vaccination right. ID and your official ID, and they're checking. They're right. not going through the motions. And they're not fucking around.
You park $8, you park underground, you take an elevator, and you're right at the theater. You're not out on the street.
It is a beautiful theater.
It is gorgeous. Gorgeous. And you know what? The dressing rooms, they take the garbage out every day. They mop the floors. It's not like, backstage can be pretty like, ooh, okay.
Seedy.
You know? Yeah,
and Rex also, if you follow him on Facebook, he does these videos from his dressing room all the time, including you're showing videos of your co-stars performing. You are such a fan of your cast.
Yeah. Because it's a combination of the entire cast. I think this is the
over 20 people in the cast and over 10 people in the music, 10 musicians and 23 people, I think, in the cast. It's really amazing. It's expensive, but it looks expensive.
And I, fortunately, I get to use my, go back to my rock and roll roots and just rip the roof off at the end of the show, because the standing O's have been, that's a standing O's.
Oh, stay for the end, because he takes off his clothes, as Rex Smith tends to do.
There you go. I'm the grandfather version of Magic Mike.
That my, you know, they're doing a Magic Mike 3. If you want somebody who's got the goods, call Rex Smith.
I think when they do part 12, I'll be ready for
Catherine. Rex, thank you so much for doing this. This has been so much fun.
It has been.
And we'll do it again in person one of these days when we're able to do stuff like that.
All right.
Thank you so much, Rex. Have a great day.
All right. Cheers.
Thanks, everyone, for watching Billy Masters Live, and thanks for hanging with us with some of the technical beginning issues. Next week will be our last week before Christmas. I can't really say because I can't check my email, but I think we have somebody really great. And if we don't, I'll still say they're great. Anyway, thanks for watching. I have been Billy Masters, and if we are here, we're live. Take care, guys. Bye-bye.